Welcome to The Business Show. We believe that our journey through this world is one we must take together, expanding, learning, and growing as a united force. We know that history is being made right now, and the decisions we make today will shape our tomorrow. These decisions will not only impact us, but will define the future for generations to come. If we don't make the right choices now, we risk creating a future we don't want. That's why we're here, to slay the dragons of the modern world and to face the challenges it brings head on. The future demands that we come together to tackle these challenges, and the only way forward is through unity and collaboration. Let's rise together, undivided, but united. Hey everybody, I'm catching up with an old friend of the podcast, the ever inspiring Mushambi Mutuma. Now the last time we interviewed him, it was to discuss his book, this book. And this time he rolled up in a sassy, classy red Mercedes Benz, as one does. And we literally drove into a powerful conversation about the evolving dance between humans and machines. And not much has changed about Mushambi's bold outlook, but the world has definitely changed because since then we've had a pandemic. We've had exponential growth in technology and AI. And this has reshaped our priorities. Humans have changed. Life feels faster, more complex, and more connected than ever. So I thought it's time to bring Mushambi back. And let's talk about the possibilities and how we can shape the future and how we can shape Africa and how we as human beings can reach our full potential by working hand in hand with machine and not rage against the machine. Well, without further ado, drum roll, how are you?
I am doing incredibly well, Carmen. Thank you so much for asking and thank you so much for having me back.
I know, right? Yeah. I was like, you know, every day when I go into our conservatory, I'm like, oh my word, look, there's Mushambi's book. I should actually have you back. And then I started seeing a lot of activity happening around AI on LinkedIn. And I was like, you know what, you should come back and let's talk about this because I'm also very passionate about this topic. So before we even get started, what have you been up to? What's going on since this book? Yes. And what's coming?
It's been a whirlwind, hey? Life has gone through all its peaks and troughs, but this year has actually kicked off exponentially well. I'm in a great space. Things are busy. I've been spending a lot of time on stage and traveling, a lot of speaking, a lot of conversations with different corporates and excos and boards, really just shaping them up for what the future of work and the future of leadership looks like. So that's been amazing. I'm quite thankful for that. And I'm trying to finish my next book. Tracy, I'm sorry. I'm a little bit behind as usual from submitting. But I'm working on my next book called The Adaptability Code. And a couple weeks off from submitting. And hopefully we'll be on shelf kind of August, I'm hoping.
Oh, that's wonderful. So what inspired this book? What is it about?
Essentially, and coming from me, it's quite strange to hear, technology doesn't matter.
Technology does not matter.
Technology, your adoption of AI or digital transformation is not what's going to be the factor for your success or your survival. It's important, but it's not the core thing. Because I was really thinking as I was working through new content and having all these conversations, I'm like, tech is going to keep changing. Tech is going to keep evolving. It's actually moving faster than ever, right? Like much faster than I ever predicted and anyone else did. But so if tech doesn't matter and it's going to continue to move at light speed, what does? And I thought it's about your adaptability. It's your flexibility. It's your resilience. It's your ability to practice foresight and curiosity. Mm-hmm. Those traits, no matter where we are in the tech journey and the AI journey, those are kind of indefensible. And I think those traits and that kind of cumulative adaptability is really going to be the best predictor for future success.
Yeah.
And so that's what I write about. So it's less tech-centric. We are going to talk about that and where things are. But the core premise is, what can you embed in yourself? How can you change your actual DNA and your literal molecular makeup for how you think, how you behave, how you act, how you plan? To be ready for disruption today, tomorrow, 10 years from now. And that's really what the book is about, is like, how do we shift our thinking?
Mm.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, like, I totally agree with you on this. I think for the past, well, since the pandemic, I've been really on this journey in trying to understand what that word authenticity means to me. And it actually came about in the weirdest way. I got diagnosed with ADHD and autism.
Right.
2022.
Oh, wow.
And found out that I was masking it. And I was like, I thought I was the most authentic person. How is it even possible? So trying to take all those layers away and starting to discover yourself for who you really are, it started making me think a lot about duality. Because in the world of artificial intelligence and technology, we cannot embark on this world and this journey without understanding duality. And what is the opposite of artificial intelligence? Authentic intelligence, right?
That's it.
And what is the key things that we need to develop in order for us to be more authentically us? Because technology, in essence, is a reflection of who we are.
It's merely a tool that
a mirror.
We use.
Whatever you prompt and whatever it brings back to you is who you are. And whatever people's biases are and what they put into
that
the technology
gets
replicated, right? And if I can be the truest version and the best version of myself engaging with technology, then we're creating technology for good, because what you put into that technology is just as important.
It's 100% it.
So I think let's take it to the next level, because I really want us to talk about, I mean, there's a lot of rage against the machine and, you know, there's a lot of negative things happening in the world. But I really want us to have a conversation around, how do we use these technologies to create hope? And I think going back to just digital citizenship, if we look at tech citizenship, we don't get a license to use this technology. We just hop on board and we do our thing on the digital highway. And there's still like a quarter of the global population that doesn't have access to the internet. People that are like with their biases come onto the technology. But then 73% of people agree that AI has this ability to improve their lives. So with that all in mind, how do we shape this narrative in how we can actually get the base level correct? Because I believe 50% of Africa's countries still don't have computer skills being taught at school, which, you know, that's a fundamental problem. In order for us to create hope of technology, we first need to get that right. What's your view on that? And how do we create hope here?
No, it's a really good question. And I think that, as you mentioned, there's a lot of rage, there's a lot of fear about what AI and tech is going. And I think a lot of that is due to the media, unfortunately. And you look at it and it's like the Terminator, Skynet, and like the robots are coming, they're taking our jobs. That you have you seen them with a gun, and their machines and robots are doing flips now, and like the world is ending. And I think that is an incorrect view, because as you mentioned, tech is merely a tool to take us from here to here. And I think what I try to do a lot is remind people that since the dawn of man, since we were created, whether in caves or wherever, every single tool that we used was technology. It was what we used to evolve from one level to the next. So tech has always been with us. This is just the latest version of it. And if we can understand that, it takes a lot of the intrinsic fear away. Then we say, okay, what is tech's role in our life? It's to help us evolve. It's to make life a little bit simpler, a little bit easier, a little bit better at the base level. So, okay, to you in your life, how can I make things a little bit easier, a little bit better, a little bit different? And what that does is it takes away the intimidating nature of it and the replacing fear that we have. Because it says, what can I do in my life easier, better, faster, cheaper with the tools that I have around me? That's technology's core basis. And with there, if you focus on that alone, then hope can be created, right? Because in whatever environment I'm in, whether I'm a kid in Khayelitsha or an entrepreneur in Kenya, whatever I can do with this tool to make life a little bit better, easier, different, faster, cheaper, then it's a little bit easier for me to get on board to accept it. Or even if I'm 60 years old and I'm thinking about retirement and I'm worried about getting pushed out of my job and all this career success that I've had not being relevant, do I ignore tech and AI, or do I have a little bit more of a shift to be open to it and experiment with it and have some curiosity still? So at every level, there's that fear and animosity, but I think we can simplify the impact and the positives. And that's where I always try to start.
Mm.
When we can get there, then we can start thinking about the next level growth and what disruption looks like and real shifts. But if we don't have a foundational element, and you'd be surprised in big corporates and in some of the most important rooms across the globe, is that that understanding doesn't always exist.
Yeah.
And so if we can get fundamental first about what the intrinsic value of tech is, then we can build and layer upon that.
Yeah. I love that you're saying that because, you know, change management is always such a huge issue within the corporate world and getting the adoptability. But I think also just to have that base understanding, but also if you look within the business models, risk aversion is built within it.
That's it.
So there's also a lot of technologies that are not being explored because of risk aversion, which rightfully so, we have to be very, very cautious in the world of all the cyber alarms going off all the time, you know. But I do feel that there needs to be spaces that, that can be created to play with technology without feeling that risk aversion hanging over your shoulder, because that, what you just mentioned, is the catalyst to this change.
Yeah. What I often say is, particularly if you're speaking to finance people and asking for sign-off and budgets, is don't tell them about risk. Call it research and development. Call it R&D, right? Just shift that perspective
for that
slightly. Because when you say risk, the red flags go up and they're like, absolutely not. But a conversation I literally had last week with a CEO of one of a major listed company, and we were talking about the reality that everyone in your company right now is using AI. 70% of people right now are using AI. They're taking sensitive company information, they're dropping it into ChatGPT and asking it to help them write some emails, right? At the base level.
Yeah.
it's not malintent. So it's, I said, so what do you do with that, right? Do you, and you don't have a policy, or maybe you have a policy and everyone is violating it. But what do you do with the knowledge that everyone is using it in your control or not? I said, you create safe places, like you mentioned. You create those sandboxes to say, hey, guys, don't take it here. Maybe don't post this kind of information. This is the impact it has, right, on IP and safety and security, as you mentioned. But here's a safe sandbox for you to go and play and create with some rules and parameters. And I do the same thing with my kids, right? When I teach them how to use tools online, it's like, these are the rules and parameters and sites that you can visit and how you can use ChatGPT, and go play safely.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, with a lot of curiosity, go do whatever you think. When you ask me questions, I'm like, go look up a video about that. My daughter literally last night asked me, how do you make glass? And I said, I could tell you, but let's go check on YouTube. And she hopped on the kids' YouTube and she looked, and she was so proud. She came back and she told me and her mom and then her brother, this is how you make glass.
I love
that. And that's what we have to inspire with tech, right?
Yeah.
Is that curiosity. Go have the freedom to go and play and see what's possible.
Yeah.
Then we can talk about how it impacts your job, or how it impacts your learning, and how it impacts your business. But if you don't have that basis, it's always going to be the scary thing that's about to take over from me, you know?
And what I also love about it is, I was actually at Henley Business School at one of the innovations workshops, and we had to explore divergent thinking and convergent thinking. One of the exercises we did, we had to, like, 2 minutes to come up, like, 200 words around an odd topic.
Yes.
And it's very hard to tap into your divergent thinking element. Look, for Carmen, it's very easy because I got ADHD, listen.
Like, so we go automatically, right?
Like, it's automatic. It's the convergent part, you know? But I think the thing that really stood out to me is how, with artificial intelligence, which is the dangerous part, is outsourcing our thinking.
That's it.
We are too lazy to think about what needs to go out. And it always is like that egg or the chicken, right? What comes first? Critical thinking? Thinking about it, and then AI, or AI, and then critical thinking.
Yes, for sure. It's a good question, and I get asked this often. It's like, are we making lazy employees or lazy human beings, right, by having all of this reliance on tech? And I think it's to your first point, is that how you use it is how it comes back to you. So if you're going to be lazy with how you input, The response will actually be kind of lazy. And one thing that I constantly prompt, because I use AI literally all day, every day. It's just a tool that I'm constantly checking and asking questions. But I always put into my instructions, don't just agree with me. Push my thinking. Respond with questions that push me to think further, right? Disagree sometimes, and then you'd be surprised about the responses that come back. And you're like, oh, okay, this is an answer to this part, but you're asking me to think about 1, 2, and 3. Wow, I hadn't considered that. And then it's not just this output to say, all right, this is the answer to 2 plus 2. It's like, oh, let's rethink math, right? Let's rethink, what are you actually trying to ask here? And I think that's a more powerful use of the tool than copy and paste whatever it just told me to do and throw that into my email and hit send, right? And I think that's the next level power of AI that doesn't make us lazy and over-reliant.
I love that. I also saw something that was quite fascinating around how universities are saying, let's assume that everybody's using AI. Mm-hmm. Tell them your assignment is to go and do this in AI, yeah, and then bring back and let's take this apart,
yes,
with critical thinking. Yes. And they say, okay, right, what's wrong with it? What did it not think of? Yeah. That we are not always reliant of technology to tell us, but that we can also say, okay, right, but I would have maybe divergently, I would have added this. That's factually, it. I would have added this. Where is the evidence? I absolutely love that prompt. I think it's such a clever way of doing it. I mean, like, this is also the other thing. We had a conversation recently also around prompt engineering and how the keywords that you use is so important, because that determines how it actually finds the data for you. Yeah, so if you're not using the correct data, is not going to find the information. So the critical thinking is key.
Yeah, it is. And I think the other reality is that when you read some communications, whether it be an email or a report, you can very clearly see as a learned person about what somebody used, right? And I was laughing with a friend of mine this week, and I was like, I've been dealing with somebody who's a service provider who keeps sending me ChatGPT outputs. And I can tell it's the free version.
Oh, right. So this is an American English.
It's like not even the pro version. You know? And it's clear and it's obvious, right? And the way that it thinks and the way that it's... So it certainly is a problem. Mm-hmm. But right now, I expect people to use AI. It's an expectation that I have. It's no longer a hint that, oh, should they or are they? No, I actually expect you in your job, in your scripting, in your thinking of this conversation, to have used AI to excel, right? But again, it's too... But it's to excel. It's not to replace.
Yeah.
Right? So if you came in here with very scripted questions to ask me, it would be a very different and stale conversation. But if it enhances you, it enhances your research and things that you hadn't thought about or didn't know or new angles, perfect. All the power to you. That's what it's there for. But I think we have to play with where we put the reliance, right? From an editing standpoint, you should use AI after this to quickly create all of the captions for our post and maybe to help post-production move a lot faster to output some clips for you. Because doing it a traditional way from 3 years ago, 4 years ago would be slow and expensive. It doesn't make sense for you to do that. So we have to use the tools that we have to make things more efficient and better. But it's about the reliance that we need to manage.
So yeah. I'm still fascinated by your prompt engineering skills over here. I mean, like, with the prompt engineering, like, what would you, if you had to provide a framework, what advice can you give our audience and how to do better prompt engineering?
Yeah, I think more is better.
More?
More is better, right? Because the less information that you give the tool, the less information it has to solve your problem, right? So I probably am guilty of asking or giving too much context, right? This is what I'm thinking about. This is the context of the situation. So for instance, thinking about my book and new ideas and new chapters are trying to test thinking. I'm thinking about a chapter about curiosity, right? I've already written 4 chapters about these things. And I'm wondering what the latest research might be as it relates to professional curiosity, right? And this is maybe 3 paragraphs of what I've already written or a snippet of another book that I saw. Can you help me find more information, right? And so my prompts and my questions are typically very long, but I think that my answers come back a lot richer because of that, and with that context in mind, and again, additional thoughts and additional questions to consider. The other thing that I was getting teased about this week, because I posted on Instagram some examples of prompts that I was doing for ChatGPT's new AI, image generator, which is literally incredible. I was playing with it a lot yesterday. People were laughing at me because every single one of my prompts says, please.
Yes.
I'm like, you know what?
Yes.
I am very kind to the robots. I want them to remember. I want them to remember my please and thank you. My mother taught me well, even to the robots. So yeah, that's another element of it.
But to that point, I also think it's so important. And I mean, I know there's a lot of people who go, why are you so friendly with the robot? But I also feel like we are minimizing our human-to-human connection.
I think
that this is the challenge with artificial intelligence, is that we are our disconnection with human beings and not seeing human beings for who they are. And I think that that is problematic. I think that everything needs to be in balance, as I mentioned earlier, duality.
Otherwise, it becomes very transactional.
Yeah.
Give me this information.
It's very masculine. Yeah. It's very
it's very aggressive. I agree.
And I think that it's important to say, okay, right, artificial intelligence is there to help me, but I still need to have the ability to be respectful, to have empathy, and to be respectful towards human beings, not just computers. I think that is the key to authentic intelligence.
It is. But remember, at the same time, as we engage with all these technologies, it's learning from us. We're teaching it how we want to be responded to. We're teaching it our tonality. We're teaching it our way of thinking. We're teaching it how we respond to certain things emotionally or just pure intelligence-wise, how we process information, right? And I think that we mustn't forget about the impact that that has.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To teaching other AIs and how it'll interact with other people, but also just how this tool says, oh, this is how this guy asks me things. Right. And this is how this guy puts information to me. You know, those things actually do matter and they affect the output at the end of the day.
Mm.
They really do.
Yeah. I think my favorite one is being succinct. I'm trying, because in my real persona, like being succinct is very hard because it's like trying to silence all the thoughts in my head and trying to make it one or two sentences is very hard.
Yeah.
So this poor AI and me have a struggle with all of these words.
But have you told it?
Yeah, no, I've started.
Have you told it that, hey, I've been diagnosed with ADHD?
Oh, no, I haven't told it that.
You should.
Yeah?
I've been diagnosed with ADHD. Being succinct is a challenge. My brain goes into lots of different places. Bear with me. Take that into consideration when you process my information. And watch and see if it improves.
Oh, my word, I'm going to try that. I love that. That's fascinating.
And that's the beauty of these things, is that if I picked up your phone now and started interacting with your ChatGPT, it would very clearly see quite immediately that somebody else was using your device.
Yeah.
Because how I speak to it is completely different to how you do. So teach it how you are. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not a negative. There's certainly prompt engineering and certain ways that you should ask questions and do it from a coding and an engineering standpoint. Yes. But at a pure human and authentic level, talk to it how you would talk to a friend and give it all the context about how you process information, because it will learn that and do better. Otherwise, you'll fight with this thing forever.
I think that, and I'll be brutally honest, because of the rise of the tech fascist the rise of digital puppetry and the lack of transparency, what our data is being used for, I have to tell you, there is a bit of skepticism when it comes to being that transparent, because I don't know what's real all the time. What are they really using? What are they not using? But with quantum computing on the horizon, like, what are we dealing with?
Yeah.
And how is that going to be, you know, how would you be penalized?
Yes, for that.
For that. Yeah. I'll give
it's
you
fair.
A simple example.
Yeah, that's fair.
If you look at people with disabilities, and the biases that they follow, or if you look even in World War II, how people were treated, aghast even
for
having disabilities. If I have to now go and say to it, I've got ADHD and autism, what happens in the future if that says, okay, right, but you're not necessarily the person that we want to bring into the workforce?
No, it's very fair.
So one has to also be a little bit cautious not to go and treat your deep, darker secrets.
Yes. No, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. And I think you're right. There does have to be some balance there. And I think that where the world is and where it's moving and what you're mentioning about kind of digital fascism is something that we have to take into account. And there's so many layers to it, right? Mm. It's 'cause your first question was like, you know, how do we get technology to be fundamental, foundational, and inspire hope? And then on the other side is like, at scale and at peak, how do we stop this thing from controlling governments and the world?
Exactly.
There's so much to discuss in all of that, right? So you're asking me the questions that are gray hair inducing, right? But I think it's to understand both sides of the spectrum,
mm-hmm.
right? To say that we're here. We can't get left behind. Right. It's happening whether we like it or not, whether we're on board or not. Right. And a lot of your information is also very readily available to everyone if they really wanted it. That's another unfortunate acceptance that we have to have. Right. But then it's like, OK, what's our role still within there? And like you said, making sure that authenticity happens and that we cater to everyone and empathy continues to happen no matter how far tech is going. Those things are how we balance. Right. And then setting up guardrails, not just for our team and our employees, but guardrails for everyone that we interact with. Right.
Mm.
Guardrails to say how you use my information. Guardrails to how you teach your AIs about where things go.
Huh.
And I think what's going to be super key for this is us having more of the technology be here within our control, right? Just this last week, it was announced that our guy Strive is building an AI, massive AI factory and data center here in South Africa in the next few years, powered by NVIDIA. We never had those kind of supercomputers readily available on the continent. There's a little bit of work happening in Morocco and some in Kenya, but to the capacity that he's currently dreaming up, that cloud capacity and AI infrastructure capacity has always existed in Europe and the US. So we don't have a ChatGPT or an open AI that is Africa-powered, Africa-sourced,
African values.
Africa values, right?
Yeah.
We don't have that. But how we get that is by the infrastructure. So it's an amazing opportunity that actually democratizes access and scale when we continue to do things. So that's why I'm so inspired by what Strive is trying to do by this. And I hope that it works out quite well and that many people follow tune, because what it does is it cheapens the cost and allows us to develop at scale things that we didn't have access to before.
Mm.
And those things are also how we keep global tech leaders accountable.
Yeah.
Right? Because we remove the over-reliance on them and say, no, man, we have this too. And we can do it by ourselves. We don't actually need you or your platform anymore. And I think that helps balance the scale a bit.
That makes my heart so happy.
Yeah.
My heart's this side, but I can't get the mic. But I mean, it makes me so happy that you're mentioning this, because for me, being a hope activist, I really want to see an era in my lifetime where it's already happened so many times. If you look at the Please Call Me, the USSD, African problems being solved by Africans.
Yes.
I believe we've got the resilience, adaptability that the rest of the world don't have, because we've had every crisis come towards us from not having energy, not having... I mean, we really know how to be resilient. But now that technology is so democratized, and now that technology, we all can build things from it. Why are we not using this technology to build our own infrastructure?
Yeah.
Why do we need to necessarily always rely on other countries? We've got all the minerals, all the resources within this continent, our partnerships and allies. How can we also use, our way of critical thinking? Because we know our mountains, we know our roads, we know all of these things.
And we have enough problems to fix still.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's 100% it. And I think it's that unity, it's that collective, it's that investment back into our own infrastructure, stopping the reliance on everybody else to come and save us and to come and build it for us. And I think that's why this wave and where we currently are is that Africa still, and I wrote about it years ago, and even now, is that we are the only place growing as fast as we are in the world. Mm. Right? 16, I believe, of the top 20 fastest growing economies are African. Right? And that will continue for the foreseeable future. Other parts of the world are aging out. I mean, Japan still has one of the oldest populations in the world. We have the youngest, right? So the future of Africa is literally, or the world, is actually the African child. It's the employee of the future. It's the consumer of the future. It's where the most tech growth is going to be coming. And that's why a lot of global companies have tried to invest here, because they see it. They see, well, what happens when we tap out of Europe and when we've used up all the resources and there's nowhere else to grow, right? What happens when we do that in Asia? What happens when we do that in the U.S.? This is the place where growth is going to happen the most. And so I think the onus is on us to take ownership of that growth and not be kind of bystanders and say, oh yeah, growth is happening and yeah, a lot of people want to come here. No, let's take ownership of that. Right. Yeah. And let's be those purveyors of hope, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
And to push something behind it and some investment and some skills and some learning and some pride. Right? Into what we have the capacity to achieve, what we've already done and where we can still go going forward. And I'm a strong believer that this is the best place in the world to be, is on the African continent.
And the safest probably as well.
You know, and we've got our stuff, right? But everywhere does. Yeah. But in all my travels, we are in the best place on earth to do business, to educate, to raise families. The opportunities and livelihood and growth that exists just here and the energy, it's not like this anywhere else on the earth. And so I think we got to take hold of that, because other people are. They see it and they come and they're like, yeah, you got something here, right? How many friends have you had visit from overseas and they're like, yo, the energy when I come here, you know, I just feel it. Yeah. What does that tell you? It's real.
Yeah.
How much do we take ownership of that and say, let's use that energy for this, this, and this?
Yeah. And I also think, just back to your point, I think all of these deals and, you know, international companies wanting to invest in South Africa, it's wonderful. But I feel like we also need to interrogate the motives.
100%.
And understand why is it? Mm. And understanding also what is the trade-off?
Yeah, no, 100%. They're coming here economically.
Yeah.
They're coming here for power opportunities, political opportunities, but also just because they see that growth is still happening.
Yeah.
And so you have to understand that authentically and say, if they're doing it, why are we not?
Yeah.
Right? Why are we not investing here? Why are we not trying to build here? Why are we not thinking about problems to fix here? Right? Why would they leave where they are to come here? And I think that's why I'm so excited when I see these massive investments happening locally by locals, right?
Mm.
Because our future should be built by us, for us, with our consideration, with our morality, with our ethos, with our Ubuntu, with our values. That should guide our future, not somebody else's. Yeah.
And I'm going to say this, although the digital divide, we really need to improve on that. I'm also going to say we have such a rich culture here, and it's important for us to build our cultural intelligence of our own country, not the cultural intelligence of America or of Europe.
100%.
And go into the villages, go and learn from the grandmas, go and learn how they survive, because those things are just as important.
Yeah,
what if some massive earthquake happens and we don't have technology anymore?
Yeah.
We don't have we can't prompt.
Yeah, for sure. You're way out of it.
You know? Anything is possible. We're learning that anything is possible.
Yeah.
Systems, everything is reliant on water, like the data centers. What if look at the crisis we had in, we still have in Johannesburg, Cape Town.
Yeah, 100%.
And they bring the data centers
exactly. No, these are real considerations. And I was laughing with friends recently about just music, right? And ownership of music. And it's like everything that we listen to now is streamed, right? You don't have that huge album of CDs or cassettes anymore that you can go to and be like, that was that one mixtape or that amazing album.
Gosh,
now you're all reliant on, you know, whatever streaming service that you are. So you're 100% right. And we're reliant on how many physical photos do you still have? Everything is sitting on the cloud, right? So a lot of people are trying to think of ways that we can preserve and take back ownership in this digital environment when everything, is essentially kind of cloud-based and outside of our control. So you're right. And I like the nuance of the cultural component that we have to take ownership of as well, and those memories and skills and values.
Yeah.
To own those and not just put those also into the digital space.
Absolutely. And like I'm such a big fan of, it's one of the intelligences that I believe that we need to develop for our authentic intelligence. I've got 7.
Yeah.
But culture intelligence is one. And culture intelligence is not just your workforce. It's really understanding each other and what cultures you are coming from and actually bringing those family members to the table. I mean, like within Conscious Leaders, we have the most fascinating conversations.
Yeah.
When it's voting season, how does your grandma and your family, approach voting?
Yeah.
And it's like a whole thing. The grandma, the matriarch sits with the entire family and then they have debates.
Yes.
Like, oh my word, we don't do those things.
How can we
learn from each other to try and adapt?
Yeah.
So I think like this is the era that we're moving into is technology is an enabler.
Yes.
But
it's not a replacer.
There is so much. Yeah.
It's not a replacer.
Yeah. 100.
Yeah.
But I love the conversation that we are having, especially around the opportunities for Africa because it's there. Mm. We just, I don't know. Do you think that sometimes there might be the imposter syndrome of Africa as a collective?
Yeah. And I mean, you could go back historically on that. Some of these things are also intentional. Right?
Yes.
They're structured economically, structured politically, right? It's a large part of colonialism. So I think a lot of that, and there is that digital colonialism that still exists now that says, maybe you guys aren't good enough. Maybe you don't deserve this. Or maybe you know what? If you invest like this, you're just going to be corrupt with it, right? Instead of telling all the amazing stories of where we are growing and where we are leading the world. So I do agree. I think that exists. I see it in entrepreneurs. I see it in business people. And what I always remind people, if you've heard me speak before, you'll know this, and if you're a friend of mine, is the bar is low.
Yes.
The bar is very low. And if you've been in different conversations and around certain tables and been in certain rooms globally, you'll realize that very few people are really as incredible as we believe that they are. There was a quote... interview with Barack Obama.
Oh, yes.
And he was saying, no, I went to Harvard and there's some really intelligent and brilliant people at Harvard. And then there's a lot that aren't. And then he's like, and then you go into the Senate or a parliament equivalent. And he's like, there's some brilliant people there. And then there's a lot that aren't. And then he's like, then you're a president and you're sitting around with other presidents and there's some brilliant ones. And then there's a lot that aren't.
Yes.
And then he's like, then you're in a room with 5 of them. And you realize that, right? And I think now, especially, so you'll take that cue, right? But I think is the way we push beyond that imposter syndrome is the understanding that the bar is tremendously low and we are exceptional across this continent and we are leaders. We're some of the brightest minds. We're some of the most creative thinkers. We've been innovating literally the longest, right? And out of raw necessity. So I think is when we shift that perspective and understand, okay, bar's low and our potential is this high, there's only exponential growth that can happen there.
Yeah.
Right? But I think it starts with mindset and understanding that. And then you could recognize your power and then you can take it on. But if you don't do that, you'll never try to compete on those stages. You'll always stay a local business. We'll stay a Joburg business and not even think about Cape Town or South Africa or Kenya or Ethiopia. You'll just always think, in small environments. Whereas other people, immediately when they think, it's like, no, this is a global business. I'm getting 100,000 people from across the world that are going to be customers, or 1 million, or 1 billion. They're not thinking in these kind of small pockets that we unfortunately often do.
Mm.
Yeah, but I think platforms like this and the work that you're doing to empower women in particular to think bigger and expand their mindsets and what they can achieve, I think they're super valuable.
Yeah, the sprinkler effect of women.
Yeah.
But I really wanna tap into your wisdom here. Is what is your point of view on innovation right now? Because I feel like we've become a very solutions-driven society, but we really don't understand the problems as much. And having a deeper understanding. I feel like our understanding of the systemic issues, because they're not interconnected, we don't understand the perspectives, is actually harmful to innovate on a shallow understanding.
Yeah. But I'll take maybe a step back, is that every time I ask people to define innovation, I get 100 different answers. Right?
Wow.
Some people say it's new thinking. Some people say it's technology. Some people say it's solving a problem. Some people say it's whatever idea that I had in the shower today. Everyone has a different definition of what it truly is to innovate. So because of that, the innovation paradox is that we all try to do it different ways.
Yeah.
Right? My definition, to try to simplify it, is innovation is the process by which we make things easier, better, and different. Right? And that, again, takes away a lot of the overthinking and the panic that we have of, like, I can't innovate. I've never innovated before. I never learned that. I'm a scientist, or I'm a mathematician, or I'm an accountant. I don't think like that. So, no, I can't think creatively. I can't be curious. Right? Like, everyone can make things a little bit easier, a little bit better, a little bit different. Everyone. Mm. And so when we lower the standard to that level, then it's easy to say, okay, cool, how do we bring frameworks on top of that? And that's what I try to do. It's like, let's, again, make it simple. Innovation for dummies.
Yeah.
Right? And then it's like, okay, when we're making things a little bit easier, how do we go through that process? When we're making things, we're trying to improve and make them a little bit better, how do we go through that process? We're trying to make things a little bit cheaper, a little bit faster. What's that process? And where does technology come in and factor in? But I think that, for me, is the real innovation problem, is that we just have too many definitions and we're all going about it in a different way. Easier, better, different, everyone can do, everyone can get on board. Yeah.
I love that. And, you know, if you think about it, we have process innovation, supply chain innovation. We are doing innovation in every part all the time. But, yeah, I think innovation for me has become such an interesting conversation, because I always think about this and I go, I sometimes feel that innovation has become a way of people trying to express their difference because they're not being accepted for being different.
That's it.
And it's just to show I can think as far left or far right as possible, just to be seen, because we're not really being understood for our differences. Yeah. And I think if there's an acceptance, and also it's becoming very individualistic, and we've adapted that culture from America, sadly to say, and the technologies. But our IQ has been decreasing year on year since the 70s. Yes. It's not increasing. Yes. And if we look at artificial intelligence and where it's at, we are now moving into a stage where if we really want to elevate our thinking and elevate innovation, it's about simulate, innovate, elevate.
Yes.
And it's about collective intelligence, brain power, joint up thinking.
Yes. No, you're spot on. And to your point, I mean, I saw the other day the stats about, you know, this generation of college students is one of the most unread generations ever, where they haven't picked up a book in even the last decade.
Yeah.
And it was so surprising to see that. And what we lose by not doing some of these things that we all grew up doing. And so what you're mentioning about IQ is so important. But I think is that that's why even now post-COVID is that how we use technology must be something that brings us together, not further apart. Because I think one of the core challenges that I have with tech, and particularly social media, is the amount of loneliness that it creates and supports, right? And how it brings us actually apart more than ever. And you see that with comments, you see that with cancel culture, you see that just with even just the anger and rage that exists online right now, is that it's so polarizing quite often. And so what you're saying about finding those cues and moments to bring us all back together to problem solve as a collective, I think is quite powerful.
Yeah, it's the only way. Yeah. Only way.
Yeah.
Those days are thinking individualistic. Mm. It's all over. And that's why we need more women. Because women are all, so a very interesting interview I had with Dr. Cherith was about in women deal with fear very differently to men.
Yeah,
so we've been taught that we all handle it with flight, fight or freeze, but women actually tend and befriend. So when they face fear, they befriend the enemy rather than
to de-escalate
potentially. And to de-escalate everything. But where that is powerful in the times that we are living in is, wouldn't having a woman and a collective of women taking care of the environment, sustainability, because they tend and befriend. And that's how it used to be. But those are the kind of things is women can actually, and I'm not saying that it's a us or a them thing. I just think that when you bring patriarchy and matriarchy together in balance with each other, that is when it's the catalyst, 100%. Is when everything is in balance. Because if things are not in balance, it creates chaos. And if chaos doesn't have a direction, it can't create structure.
No, you're spot on. And I think I struggle with this on a daily basis, just parenting. I mean, I've got a 10-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son. If I had to parent them alone, just as me, single dad, they would have a very different upbringing. It'd probably be a lot harsher and a lot more rigid and a lot more rules. They'd be successful. They'd be happy. But their take of how they do karate or school or swimming would be informed by my kind of masculine, aggressive personality that's very type A. And the fact that they have a mother who's so creative and so loving and so nurturing, still very rule-based and very driven, but softens their entire experience. And I think that she also couldn't imagine trying to do that by herself either. So what you're saying about bringing patriarchy and matriarchy together, for me, is a perfect combination, because I see it on a daily basis of just trying to build amazing kids, right, that are whole-rounded. And so sometimes I'm like, oh, you've been spending a little bit too much time with me. Go spend some time with mommy. Or, you know, I can't deal with this problem right now because how I'm viewing it is like this. We actually need mommy's voice in the room. And then sometimes she's like, you know what? I can't deal with you. You need to go speak to your dad.
I love that.
Like, that's it. Come here and resolve this. Right? And so I think it's super, I mean, it's foundational in a family structure. So why not on a societal level? So you're, I think you're spot on. And I think that's why diversity is so important.
Yeah.
And we can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Is we need different perspectives and different voices now more than ever. We can't just go in single-minded and with this one consolidated view. No, we need everyone to kind of participate, particularly in leadership, particularly in business, particularly in the corporate environment. We need as many voices as possible. So you're spot on.
Bronwyn Williams says, you can't code morality.
It's
because
true.
Then you suppress and oppress people. And you know, I personally feel that if you start actually dive, I was shocked when I started really doing my research on the biases on technology for women. I mean, women would be served 75 times more negative news when you Google from a female name. Now, I've got a Mexican Spanish name. Can you please?
Imagine.
Do you know? Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm not going to say it out loud.
But it's very, very real. And those biases exist, right?
Yeah.
Just a few years ago. I mean, I remember Google had an image issue when you would search for black people on image search and monkeys would pop up. So all these things happen. Women, tremendously with medical care, are completely underserved or served particular kinds of information and responses.
I love that you know that. Shows me you're a true ally.
I'm trying my best.
That.
Yeah. Girl dad, you know, you have to. You got to build a better world for her and for all of our children. So it's important. But I think that you're spot on. But I think this is also why our inputs into AI also matter, because we're all training these modules for all of our inputs, yours, mine, not just for ourselves, but we're training the collective. It's not just a bunch of engineers in Silicon Valley training them anymore. It's all of our collective inputs. So we do need more information. We need more perspectives. We need more cultures to be involved into framing technology. Otherwise, it will be this monolithic thought process and output that doesn't consider women, doesn't consider minorities, doesn't consider, you know, groups that have been disenfranchised.
Absolutely.
So you're spot on. Yeah.
Okay, so before, I'm going to ask you a few fun questions because the last time you were here, we actually had a game. I've evolved as a person. before that, I want to ask, what advice would you give a board of directors right now in how to be more adaptable in this time that we're living in?
It's a hard one because they have so many rules and parameters, but it would to let down your guard, actually.
Wow.
Get rid of risk sometimes. Create a parameter, create those safe, free zones for people to innovate freely without constriction. And there's ways that we can do it. There's ways we can create those sandboxes. Even in the most, I mean, a client recently was in the pharmaceutical space, and that is one of the most regulated industries ever, right? And it has to be because it's our bodies, it's our health, right? But there's still ways that you can create sandboxes for people to go and create and innovate, because what we do is we say, everyone go be an innovator, but we don't give them any tools on how to do that. Mm. We don't give them any safety to be able to have some failures, right, to be able to build up those resilience. So I say create sandboxes and environments where we can fail, where we can lose money, where we can miss KPIs, right? We can be behind schedule, but guess what? We can test, we can learn, we can experiment, we can grow, we can have some fun. That's what we have to do. And I would inspire every company to do so and to incentivize it. And when you do that, you get the happiest employee, and actually you get amazing products and ideas out of it. So it's actually good for business.
I love
that. You know, there's actually financial impact that you might not feel immediately, but you're going to in the very soon future. And when you can shift board of directors, exco members, mancos, and shift it, hey, by doing these things that feel so risky, shifting it to R&D, as we mentioned, there's real opportunities for you to actually grow and be an amazing workplace and to make some money. It's all good. So that's what we try to push.
Yeah, I think it's the best advice ever. Yeah. I mentioned to you, we started this African micro-learning accelerator conference, think of bringing everybody across industries, across places and spaces together to think collectively and creatively about how we innovate on systemic issues.
Yeah.
And it's so, so important to take that guardrail off. I love that you're saying that sandbox, there needs to be sacred spaces. Like, it's so necessary.
Yeah. Otherwise, there's so many rules and structures. And it's like, no, man, I can't bring that idea. That idea, I don't know if it's going to make some money. So that means it's not a good idea.
Well, and the judgment.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Yeah.
It's just so fear. We're scared of failure. We don't want to fail. We've been ingrained since we were children to not fail, to not make the wrong answer, to not put up our hand when we weren't 100% sure, to not bring home a bad grade because it meant we weren't paying attention or we didn't understand. Whereas failure is actually just a necessary part of life. And the most successful businesses, none of them made financial sense when they were concepts. They did none of them, trust me. None of them are like, this is a really bad business model, actually. But look now. Right? Look now.
Yeah, right? I love that.
And that's the reality. Right. I mean, the platform that you're listening to or watching this on right now was a horrible business model. I guarantee it. Right?
I love that.
But look at where it is now. And I think that's where we have to shift the perspective of failure and risk, is that embrace it. Give it some rules. Yes. Right. We don't want to be irresponsible. Mm. So, but you have to allow it. Otherwise, growth is not going to occur, because growth doesn't occur in the comfortable and in the safe. It occurs when there's some tension and when there's some disagreements about how to do things and when there's just some experimentation or where there's a way around. That's where growth occurs. It's not in the most traditional environments. Yeah.
Stunning advice. Stunning. Thank you. Okay. So we used to do these 1 minute games.
Yeah.
And I thought, since we've had you here before and it was before the pandemic, we're not going to do a 1 minute game. I'm going to ask you a few questions and I just want you to give it to us what comes top of mind.
All right.
Okay. First one.
Yes.
What would you put on a billboard?
Be curious.
Great answer. What is the best purchase of 100 Rand or less?
A book.
What is the most gifted or recommended book, but not yours?
The Bible.
Wonderful. What tips and hacks can you provide when you use AI?
I think it was that prompting example that I mentioned earlier. Is like,
yeah, but now you have to come up with another one because we've already asked that.
No, okay. Ask it. How can you teach me something I don't know in the next 30 days? And see what it breaks down for you.
Genius. Yeah. See, I had to push him. Push him.
There we go.
All right. What is the most random thing you know?
What's the most random thing that I know? I'm just thinking what my kids have taught me in the last couple of days. We've been working on pronouns and adverbs and pronouns and all kinds of stuff. So I'm learning English terms that I didn't know existed. Jeez, I don't know, hey? Oh, my goodness. I wish my son was here. He'd be like, I told you yesterday, Dad. I'll give you one. Yeah, go ahead.
Did you know that a cloud in the sky can weigh up to 500 kgs to a ton?
I did not know that. I didn't know clouds had weight.
As above, so below.
Sure. Hey? That makes logical sense. Wow, okay.
Isn't that the craziest thing?
I'm going to go repeat that today. Thank you.
Looking at a cloud, oh my gosh, this is a ton.
The school drop-off is going to be amazing today. I've got new information. Thank you.
There you go. Anyway, I just want to say thank you so much. I had such a wonderful conversation. I always love the fact, I love these chairs because when I sit in these chairs, I feel like I can have like proper like sofa conversations. Yeah. But I mean, this was really just so divine.
Thank you.
And really getting your perspective. And especially because, you know, this is what you do all day long, every day.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for your book to come out.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll make sure to get you a copy. And I'd love your thoughts on it.
Oh, definitely.
Because I think as a true adaptable force, you certainly are. So, yeah, it'd be a pleasure. But thank you for the platform. Thank you for what you're doing. It's truly meaningful. It's not just content. I think the conversations that you have and the work that you're doing is really quite impactful. So thank you for considering me.
Thank you.
And it's an absolute pleasure. So keep growing and rising.
Back at you. We're all rising because we're African, right?
That's it.
All right. That's a wrap, everybody. Thank you so much for staying tuned. And you might need a notepad and a pen and listen to it again because there's a lot of wisdom in there. And you know, I always say, take the conversation and put it into ChatGPT after you've listened to it to even stretch your mind further on the things that we've discussed. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.